I guess it sounds pretty nutty, doesn't it?
Yes, Irv said gravely. It sounds nutty as anything I ever heard.
He was sitting lightly, slightly tense on his chair, and Andy thought, he's expecting me to do something loony the first chance I get.
I suppose it doesn't matter much anyway, Andy said. They'll be here soon enough. I think the police would actually be better. At least you don't turn into an unperson as soon as the police get their hands on you.
Irv started to reply, and then the door opened. Norma and Charlie came in. Charlie's face was bright, her eyes sparkling. Daddy, she said. Daddy, I fed the... She broke off. Some of the color left her cheeks, and she looked narrowly from Irv Manders to her father and back to Irv again. Pleasure faded from her face and was replaced with a look of harried misery. The way she looked last night, Andy thought. The way she looked yesterday when I grabbed her out of school. It goes on, and where's the happy ending for her?
You told? She said.
Oh, Daddy, why did you tell?
Norma stepped forward and put a protective arm around Charlie's shoulders.
Irv, what's going on here?
I don't know, Irv said.
What do you mean he told, Bobby?
That's not my name, she said. Tears had appeared in her eyes. You know that's not my name.
Charlie, Andy said. Mr. Manders knew something was wrong. I told him, but he didn't believe me. When you think about it, you'll understand why.
I don't understand anything, Charlie began, her voice rising stridently.
Then she was quiet, her head cocked sideways in a peculiar listening gesture, although as far as any of the others could tell, there was nothing to listen to. As they watched, Charlie's face simply drained of color. It was like watching rich liquid poured out of a pitcher.
What's the matter, honey? Norma asked, and cast a worried glance at Irv.
They're coming, Daddy, Charlie whispered.
Her eyes were wide circles of fear.
They're coming for us.
11.
They had rendezvoused at the corner of Highway 40 and the unnumbered blacktop road Irv had turned down. On the Hastings Glentown maps, it was marked as the Old Bailings Road. Al Steinowitz had finally caught up with the rest of his men and had taken over quickly and decisively. There were 16 of them in 5 cars. Heading up the road toward Irv Manders' place, they looked like a fast-moving funeral procession. Norville Bates had handed over the reins and the responsibility of the operation to Al with genuine relief and with a question about the local and state police who had been rung in on the operation.
"We're keeping this one dark for now," Al said. "If we get them, we'll tell them they can fold their roadblocks. If we don't, we'll tell them to start moving in toward the center of the circle. But between you and me, if we can't handle them with 16 men, we can't handle them, Norv."
Norv sensed the mild rebuke and said no more. He knew it would be best to take the two of them with no outside interference because Andrew McGee was going to have an unfortunate accident as soon as they got him. A fatal accident. With no blue suits hanging around, it could happen that much sooner. Ahead of him and Al, the brake lights of O.J.'s car flashed briefly, and then the car turned onto a dirt road. The others followed.
Twelve.
I don't understand any of this, Norma said. Bobby? Charlie, can't you calm down?
You don't understand, Charlie said. Her voice was high and strangled. Looking at her made Irv jumpy. Her face was like that of a rabbit caught in a snare. She pulled free of Norma's arm and ran to her father, who put his hands on her shoulders.
"I think they're going to kill you, Daddy," she said.
"What?"
"Kill you," she repeated.
Her eyes were staring and glazed with panic. Her mouth worked frantically.
"We have to run. We have to—"
"Hot. Too hot in here."
He glanced to his left. Mounted on the wall between the stove and the sink was an indoor thermometer, the kind that can be purchased from any mail-order catalog. At the bottom of this one, a plastic red devil with a pitchfork was grinning and mopping his brow. The motto beneath his cloven hooves read, "Hot enough for you?" The mercury in the thermometer was slowly rising, an accusing red finger.
"Yes, that's what they want to do," she said. "Kill you. Kill you like they did Mommy. Take me away. I won't. I won't let it happen. I won't let it—"
Her voice was rising, rising like a column of mercury. "Charlie, watch what you're doing."
Her eyes cleared a little. Irv and his wife had drawn together.
"Irv, what?"
But Irv had seen Andy's glance at the thermometer, and suddenly he believed. It was hot in here now, hot enough to sweat. The mercury in the thermometer stood just above 90 degrees. "Holy Jesus Christ," he said hoarsely. "Did she do that, Frank?" Andy ignored him. His hands were still on Charlie's shoulders. He looked into her eyes. "Charlie, do you think it's too late? How does it feel to you?"
"Yes," she said.
All the color was gone from her face.
"They're coming up the dirt road now. Oh, Daddy, I'm scared."
"You can stop them, Charlie," he said quietly. She looked at him. "Yes," he said.
"But, Daddy, it's bad. I know it is. I could kill them."
"Yes," he said. "Maybe now it's kill or be killed. Maybe it's come down to that."
"It's not bad?"
Her voice was almost inaudible. "Yes," Andy said, "it is. Never kid yourself that it isn't. And don't do it if you can't handle it, Charlie, not even for me." They looked at each other eye to eye, Andy's eyes tired and bloodshot and frightened, Charlie's eyes wide, nearly hypnotized. She said,
"If I do
something, will you still love me?" The question hung between them, lazily revolving. "Charlie," he said, "I'll always love you no matter what." Irv had been at the window, and now he crossed the room to them.
"I think I got some tall apologizing to do," he said. "There's a whole line of cars coming up the road. I'll stand with you if you want. I got my deer gun."
But he looked suddenly frightened, almost sick. Charlie said, "You don't need your gun." She slipped out from under her father's hands and walked across to the screen door, in Norma Mander's knitted white sweater, looking even smaller than she was. She let herself out. After a moment, Andy found his feet and went after her. His stomach felt frozen, as if he'd just gobbled a huge Dairy Queen cone in 3 bites. The Manders stayed behind. Andy caught one last look at the man's baffled, frightened face, and a random thought, "That'll teach you to pick up hitchhikers," darted across his consciousness. Then he and Charlie were on the porch, watching the first of the cars turn up the long driveway. The hens squawked and fluttered. In the barn, Bossy mooed again for someone to come and milk her, and thin October sunshine lay over the wooded ridges and autumn-brown fields of this small upstate New York town. It had been almost a year of running, and Andy was surprised to find an odd sense of relief mixed in with his sharp terror. He had heard that in its extremity even a rabbit will sometimes turn and face the dogs, driven back to some earlier, less meek nature at the instant before it must be torn apart. At any rate, it was good not to be running. He stood with Charlie, the sunshine mellow on her blonde hair.
"Oh, Daddy," she moaned, "I can't hardly stand up."
He put his arm around her shoulders and pulled her more tightly against his side. The first car stopped at the head of the dooryard, and 2 men got out. XIII.
"Hi, Andy," Al Steinowitz said and smiled. "Hi, Charlie."
His hands were empty, but his coat was open. Behind him, the other man stood alertly by the car, hands at his sides. The second car stopped behind the first, and 4 more men spilled out. All the cars were stopping, all the men getting out. Andy counted a dozen and then stopped counting.
"Go away," Charlie said.
Her voice was thin and high in the cool early afternoon.
"You've led us a merry chase," Al said to Andy. He looked at Charlie. "Honey, you don't have to..." "Go away," she screamed.
Al shrugged and smiled disarmingly.
"Afraid I can't do that, honey. I have my orders. No one wants to hurt you or your daddy." "You liar! You're supposed to kill him. I know it."
Andy spoke and was a little surprised to find that his voice was completely steady.
"I advise you to do as my daughter says. You've surely been briefed enough to know why she's wanted. You know about the soldier at the airport."
O.J. and Norval Bates exchanged a sudden uneasy look.
"If you'll just get in the car, we can discuss all of this," Al said. "Honest to gosh, there's nothing going on here except..."
"We know what's going on," Andy said. The men who had been in the last 2 or 3 cars were beginning to fan out and stroll almost casually toward the porch.
"Please," Charlie said to the man with the strangely yellow face. "Don't make me do anything."
"It's no good, Charlie," Andy said. Irv Manders came out onto the porch.
"You men are trespassing," he said. I want you to get the hell off my property. Three of the shopmen had come up the front steps of the porch and were now standing less than 10 yards away from Andy and Charlie to their left.
Charlie threw them a warning, desperate glance, and they stopped, for the moment.
We're government agents, sir, Al Steinowitz said to Irv in a low, courteous voice. These two folks are wanted for questioning. Nothing more. I don't care if they're wanted for assassinating the president, Irv said. His voice was high, cracking. Show me your warrant or get the Christ off my property. We don't need a warrant, Al said. His voice was edged with steel now. You do unless I woke up in Russia this morning, Irv said. I'm telling you to get off and you better get high-steppin', mister. That's my last word on it.
Irv, come inside, Norma cried.
Andy could feel something building in the air, building up around Charlie like an electric charge. The hair on his arm suddenly began to stir and move like kelp in an invisible tide. He looked down at her and saw her face so small, now so strange. It's coming, he thought helplessly. It's coming. Oh, my God, it really is.
Get out, he shouted at Al. Don't you understand what she's going to do? Can't you feel it? Don't be a fool, man. Please, Al said.
He looked at the three men standing at the far end of the porch and nodded to them imperceptibly. He looked back at Andy.
If we can only discuss this... Watch it, Frank! Irv Mander screamed.
The three men at the end of the porch suddenly charged at them, pulling their guns as they came.
Hold it! Hold it! One of them yelled. Just stand still! Hands over your...
Charlie turned toward them. As she did so, half a dozen other men, John Mayo and Ray Knowles among them, broke for the porch's back steps with their guns drawn. Charlie's eyes widened a little, and Andy felt something hot pass by him in a warm puff of air. The three men at the front end of the porch had got halfway toward them when their hair caught on fire. A gun boomed, deafeningly loud, and a splinter of wood, perhaps 8 inches long, jumped from one of the porch's supporting posts. Norma Mander screamed, and Andy flinched, but Charlie seemed not to notice. Her face was dreamy and thoughtful. A small Mona Lisa smile had touched the corners of her mouth. She's enjoying this, Andy thought, with something like horror. Is that why she's so afraid of it? Because she likes it? Charlie was turning back toward Al Steinowitz again. The three men he had sent running down toward Andy and Charlie from the front end of the porch had forgotten their duty to God, country, and the shop. They were beating at the flames on their heads and yelling. The pungent smell of fried hair suddenly filled the afternoon. Another gun went off. A window shattered.
Not the girl, Al shouted. Not the girl!
Andy was seized roughly. The porch swirled with a confusion of men. He was dragged toward the railing through the chaos. Then someone tried to pull him a different way. He felt like a tug-of-war rope.
Let him go, Irv Mander shouted, bull-throated. Let him!
Another gun went off, and suddenly Norma was screaming again, screaming her husband's name over and over. Charlie was looking down at Al Steinowitz, and suddenly the cold, confident look was gone from Al's face, and he was in terror. His yellow complexion grew positively cheesy. No, don't, he said, in an almost conversational tone of voice. Don't. It was impossible to tell where the flames began. Suddenly his pants and his sport coat were blazing. His hair was a burning bush. He backed up, screaming, bounced off the side of his car, and half-turned to Norville Bates, his arms stretched out. Andy felt that soft rush of heat again. A displacement of air, as if a hot slug thrown at rocket speed had just passed his nose. Al Steinowitz's face caught on fire. For a moment, he was all there, screaming silently under a transparent call of flame, and then his features were blending, merging, running like tallow. Norville shrank away from him. Al Steinowitz was a flaming scarecrow. He staggered blindly down the driveway, waving his arms, and then collapsed face down beside the third car. He didn't look like a man at all. He looked like a burning bundle of rags. The people on the porch had frozen, staring dumbly at this unexpected blazing development. The three men whose hair Charlie had fired had all managed to put themselves out. They were all going to look decidedly strange in the future, however short that might be. Their hair, short by regulation, now looked like blackened, tangled clots of ash on top of their heads.
"Get out!" Andy said hoarsely. Get out quickly. She's never done anything like this before, and I don't know if she can stop.
I'm all right, Daddy, Charlie said.
Her voice was calm, collected, and strangely indifferent. Everything's okay. And that was when the cars began to explode. They all went up from the rear. Later, when Andy replayed the incident at the Mander's farm in his mind, he was quite sure of that. They all went up from the rear where the gas tanks were. Al's light green Plymouth went first, exploding with a muffled whirrump sound. A ball of flame rose from the back of the Plymouth, too bright to look at. The rear window blew in. The Ford John and Ray had come in went next, barely 2 seconds later. Hooks of metal wickered through the air and pattered on the roof. "Charlie!" Andy shouted. "Charlie, stop it!" She said in that same calm voice, "I can't." The third car went up. Someone ran. Someone else followed him. The men on the porch began to back away. Andy was tugged again. He resisted, and suddenly no one at all was holding him. And suddenly they were all running, their faces white, eyes stare-blind with panic. One of the men with the charred hair tried to vault over the railing, caught his foot, and fell headfirst into a small side garden where Norma had grown beans earlier in the year. The stakes for the beans to climb on were still there, and one of them ran through the fellow's throat and came out the other side with a wet punching sound that Andy never forgot. He twitched in the garden like a landed trout, the bean pole protruding from his neck like the shaft of an arrow, blood gushing down the front of his shirt as he made weak gargling sounds. The rest of the cars went up then like an ear-shattering string of firecrackers. Two of the fleeing men were tossed aside like rag dolls by the concussion, one of them on fire from the waist down, the other peppered with bits of safety glass. Dark, oily smoke rose in the air. Beyond the driveway, the far hills and fields twisted and writhed through the heat shimmer as if recoiling in horror. Chickens ran madly everywhere, clucking crazily. Suddenly, three of them exploded into flame and went rushing off, balls of fire with feet, to collapse on the far side of the dooryard. "Charlie, stop it right now! Stop it!" A trench of fire raced across the dooryard on a diagonal, the very dirt blazing in a single straight line, as if a train of gunpowder had been laid. The flame reached the chopping block with Irv's axe buried in it, made a fairy ring around it, and suddenly collapsed inward. The chopping block whooshed into flame. "Charlie, for Christ's sake!" Some shop agent's pistol was lying on the verge of the grass between the porch and the blazing line of cars in the driveway. Suddenly, the cartridges in it began to go off in a series of sharp, clapping explosions. The gun jigged and flipped bizarrely in the grass. Andy slapped her as hard as he could. Her head rocked back, her eyes blue and vacant. Then she was looking at him, surprised and hurt and dazed, and he suddenly felt enclosed in a capsule of swiftly building heat. He took in a breath of air that felt like heavy glass. The hairs on his nose felt as if they were crisping. "Spontaneous combustion," he thought. "I'm going up in a burst of spontaneous combustion." Then it was gone. Charlie staggered on her feet and put her hands up to her face. And then, through her hands, came a shrill building scream of such horror and dismay that Andy feared her mind had cracked. "Daddy!" He swept her into his arms, hugged her. "Shh," he said. "Oh, Charlie, honey, shh." The scream stopped, and she went limp in his arms. Charlie had fainted. 14. Andy picked her up in his arms, and her head rolled limply against his chest. The air was hot and rich with the smell of burning gasoline. Flames had already crawled across the lawn to the ivy trellis. Fingers of fire began to climb the ivy with the agility of a boy on midnight business. The house was going to go up. Irv Manders was leaning against the kitchen screen door, his legs splayed. Norma knelt beside him. He had been shot above the elbow, and the sleeve of his blue work shirt was a bright red. Norma had torn a long strip of her dress off at the hem and was trying to get his shirt sleeve up so she could bind the wound. Irv's eyes were open. His face was an ashy gray, his lips were faintly blue, and he was breathing fast. Andy took a step toward them, and Norma Manders flinched backwards, at the same time placing her body over her husband's. She looked up at Andy with shiny, hard eyes. "Get away," she hissed. "Take your monster and get away." 15. O.J. ran. The windsucker bounced up and down under his arm as he ran. He ignored the road as he ran. He ran in the field. He fell down and got up and ran on. He twisted his ankle in what might have been a chuck hole and fell down again, a scream jerking out of his mouth as he sprawled. Then he got up and ran on. At times it seemed that he was running alone, and at times it seemed that someone was running with him. It didn't matter. All that mattered was getting away, away from that blazing bundle of rags that had been Al Steinowitz 10 minutes before, away from that burning train of cars, away from Bruce Cook, who lay in a small garden patch with a stake in his throat. Away, away, away. The windsucker fell out of its holster, struck his knee painfully, and fell in a tangle of weeds, forgotten. Then O.J. was in a patch of woods. He stumbled over a fallen tree and sprawled full length. He lay there, breathing raggedly, one hand pressed to his side, where a painful stitch had formed. He lay weeping tears of shock and fear. He thought, no more assignments in New York. Never, that's it, everybody out of the pool. I'm never setting foot in New York again, even if I live to be 200. After a little while, O.J. got up and began to limp toward the road.
Let's get him off the porch, Andy said. He had laid Charlie on the grass beyond the dooryard. The side of the house was burning now, and sparks were drifting down on the porch like big, slow-moving fireflies.
Get away, she said harshly. Don't touch him.
The house is burning, Andy said. Let me help you.
Get away. You've done enough.
Stop it, Norma. Irv looked at her.
None of what happened was this man's fault, so shut your mouth.
She looked at him as if she had a great many things to say, and then shut her mouth with a snap.
Get me up, Irv said. Legs feel all rubber. Think maybe I pissed myself. Shouldn't be surprised. One of those bastards shot me. Don't know which one. Lend a hand, Frank.
It's Andy, he said, and got an arm around Irv's back. Little by little, Irv came up. I don't blame you, missus. You should have passed us by this morning.
If I had it to do over again, I'd do it just the same way, Irv said. Gosh damn people coming on my land with guns. Gosh damn bastards and fucking bunch of government whoremasters and... Ow! Oh, Christ!
Irv, Norma cried.
Hush, woman! I got it knocked now. Come on, Frank, or Andy, or whatever your name is. It's getting hot.
It was. A puff of wind blew a coil of sparks onto the porch as Andy half-dragged Irv down the steps and into the dooryard. The chopping block was a blackened stump. There was nothing left of the chickens Charlie had set on fire, but a few charred bones and a peculiar dense ash that might have been feathers. They had not been roasted, they had been cremated.
"Set me down by the barn," Irv gasped. "I want to talk to you."
"You need a doctor," Andy said.
"Yeah, I'll get my doctor. What about your girl?"
"Fainted." He set Irv down with his back against the barn door. Irv was looking up at him. A little color had come into his face, and that bluish cast was leaving his lips. He was sweating. Behind them, the big white farmhouse that had stood there on the Bailings Road since 1868 was going up in flames.
"There's no human being should be able to do what she can," Irv said.
"That may well be," Andy said, and then he looked from Irv and directly into Norma Mander's stony, unforgiving face. "But then no human being should have to have cerebral palsy or muscular dystrophy or leukemia, but it happens, and it happens to children."
"She didn't get no say," Irv nodded.
"All right." Still looking at Norma, Andy said, "She's no more a monster than a kid in an iron lung or in a home for retarded children."
"I'm sorry I said that,"
Norma replied, and her glance wavered and fell from Andy's. "I was out feeding the chickens with her, watching her pet the cow, but, mister, my house is burning down, and people are dead." "I'm sorry."
"The house is insured, Norma," Irv said, taking her hand with his good one.
"That doesn't do anything about my mother's dishes that her mother gave to her," Norma said, "or my nice secretary, or the pictures we got at the Schenectady Art Show last July." A tear slipped out of one eye, and she wiped it away with her sleeve.
"And all the letters you wrote to me when you were in the army?" "Is your button going to be all right?" Irv asked.
"I don't know."
"Well, listen. Here's what you can do if you want to. There's an old Willie's Jeep out behind the barn."
"Irv, no!
Don't get into this any deeper."
He turned to look at her, his face gray and lined and sweaty. Behind them, their home burned. The sound of popping shingles was like that of horse chestnuts in a Christmas fire.
"Those men came with no warrants, nor blueback paper of any kind, and tried to take them off our land," he said. "People I'd invited in like it's done in a civilized country with decent laws. One of them shot me, and one of them tried to shoot Andy here. Missed his head by no more than a quarter of an inch." Andy remembered the first deafening report and the splinter of wood that had jumped from the porch support post. He shivered.
They came and did those things. What do you want me to do, Norma? Sit here and turn them over to the secret police if they get their peckers up enough to come back? Be a good German?
No, she said huskily. No, I guess not.
You don't have to, Andy began.
I feel I do, Irv said.
And when they come back, they will be back, won't they, Andy?
Oh, yes, they'll be back. You just bought stock in a growth industry, Irv.
Irv laughed, a whistling, breathless sound.
That's pretty good, all right.
Well, when they show up here, all I know is that you took my willies. I don't know more than that. And to wish you well.
Thank you, Andy said quietly.
We gotta be quick, Irv said. It's a long way back to town, but they'll have seen the smoke by now. Fire trucks will be coming. You said you and the button were going to Vermont? Was that much the truth?
Yes, Andy said. There was a moaning sound to their left.
Daddy?
Charlie was sitting up. The red pants and green blouse were smeared with dirt. Her face was pale. Her eyes were terribly confused.
Daddy, what's burning? I smell something burning.
Am I doing it? What's burning? Andy went to her and gathered her up.
Everything is all right, he said,
and wondered why you had to say that to children, even when they knew perfectly well, as you did, that it wasn't true.
Everything's fine. How do you feel, hon?
Charlie was looking over his shoulder at the burning line of cars, the convulsed body in the garden, and the Mander's house, which was crowned with fire. The porch was also wrapped in flames. The wind was carrying the smoke and heat away from them, but the smell of gas and hot shingles was strong.
I did that, Charlie said, almost too low to hear.
Her face began to twist and crumple again.
Button, Irv said sternly.
She glanced over at him, through him.
Me? She moaned.
Set her down, Irv said. I want to talk to her. Andy carried Charlie over to where Irv sat propped up against the barn door and set her down.
You listen to me, Button, Irv said. Those men meant to kill your daddy. You knew it before I did, maybe before he did, although I'll be damned if I know how. Am I right?
Yes, Charlie said. Her eyes were still deep and miserable.
But you don't get it.
It was like the soldier, but worse. I couldn't hold on to it anymore. It was going every place. I burned up some of your chickens, and I almost burned up my father.
The miserable eyes spilled over, and she began to cry helplessly. Your daddy's fine, Irv said.
Andy said nothing. He remembered that sudden strangling sensation, being enclosed in that heat capsule.
I'm never going to do it again, she said. Never.
All right, Andy said, and put a hand on her shoulder.
All right, Charlie.
Never, she repeated with quiet emphasis.
You don't want to say that, Button, Irv said, looking up at her. You don't want to block yourself off like that. You'll do what you have to do. You'll do the best you can, and that's all you can do. I believe the one thing the God of this world likes best is to give the business to people who say never. You understand me?
No, Charlie whispered.
But you will, I think, Irv said, and looked at Charlie with such deep compassion that Andy felt his throat fill with sorrow and fear.
Then Irv glanced at his wife.
Bring me that there stick by your foot, Norma.
Norma brought the stick and put it into his hand and told him again that he was overdoing it, that he had to rest. And so it was only Andy that heard Charlie say, never again, almost inaudibly under her breath, like a vow taken in secrecy.
XVII
Look here, Andy, Irv said and drew a straight line in the dust. This is the dirt road we came up, the Bailings Road. If you go a quarter of a mile north, you'll come to a woods road on your right. A car can't make it up that road, but the Willie should do it if you keep her wound up and use an educated foot on the clutch. A couple of times it's going to look like that road just up and died, but you keep going and you'll pick it up again. It's not on any map, you understand? Not on any map.
Andy nodded, watching the stick drawing the woods road.
It'll take you 12 miles east, and if you don't get stuck or lost, you'll come out on Route 152 near Hogue Corners. You turn left, north, and about a mile up 152, you'll come to another woods road. It's low ground, swampy, mushy. The Willies might do it, might not. I ain't been on that road in 5 years, I guess. It's the only one I know that goes east toward Vermont and won't be roadblocked off. That second road is going to bring you out on Highway 22, north of Cherry Plain and south of the Vermont border. By then you should be out of the worst of it, although I suppose they'll have your name and pictures on the wire, but we wish you the best. Don't we, Norma?
Yes, Norma said, and the word was almost a sigh. She looked at Charlie.
You saved your dad's life, little girl. That's the thing to remember.
Is it? Charlie said, and her voice was so perfectly toneless that Norma Manders looked bewildered and a little afraid. Then Charlie tried a hesitant smile, and Norma smiled back, relieved.
Keys are in the willies, and he cocked his head to one side. Hark!
It was the sound of sirens, rising and falling in cycles, still faint but drawing closer.
It's the FD, Irv said. You better go if you're going.
Come on, Charlie, Andy said. She came to him, her eyes red from her tears. The small smile had disappeared like hesitant sunlight behind the clouds, but Andy felt greatly encouraged that it had been there at all. The face she wore was a survivor's face, shocked and wounded. In that moment, Andy wished he had her power. He would use it, and he knew whom he would use it on. He said, "Thank you, Irv."
"I'm sorry," Charlie said in a small voice, "about your house and your chickens and
everything else."
"It sure wasn't your fault, Button," Irv said. "They brought it on themselves. You watch out for your daddy."
"All right," she said. Andy took her hand and led her around the barn to where the Willys was parked under a shake pole lean-to. The fire sirens were very close by the time he had got it started and driven it across the lawn to the road. The house was an inferno now. Charlie would not look at it. The last Andy saw of the Manders was in the rearview mirror of the canvas-top Jeep. Irv leaning against the barn, the piece of white skirting knotted around his wounded arm stained red, Norma sitting beside him. His good arm was around her. Andy waved, and Irv gestured a bit in return with his bad arm. Norma didn't wave, thinking perhaps of her mother's china, her secretary, the love letters, all the things of which insurance money is ignorant and always has been.
18. They found the first woods road just where Irv Manders had said they would. Andy put the Jeep in four-wheel drive and turned onto it.
"Hold on, Charlie," he said. "We're going to bounce."
Charlie held on. Her face was white and listless, and looking at her made Andy nervous. The cottage, he thought. Grandther McGee's cottage on Tashmore Pond. If we can only get there and rest, she'll get herself back together, and then we'll think about what we should do. We'll think about it tomorrow. Like Scarlett said, it's another day.
The Willys roared and pitched its way up the road, which was no more than a two-wheel track with bushes and even a few stunted pines growing along the crown. This land had been logged over maybe 10 years ago, and Andy doubted if it had been used since then, except by an occasional hunter. 6 miles up, it did seem to up and die, and Andy had to stop twice to move trees that had blown down. The second time he looked up from his exertions, heart and head pounding almost sickeningly, and saw a large doe looking at him thoughtfully. She held a moment longer and then was gone into the deeper woods with a flip of her white tail. Andy looked back at Charlie and saw she was watching the deer's progress with something like wonder, and he felt encouraged again. A little farther on, they found the wheel ruts again, and around 3 o'clock they came out on the stretch of two-lane blacktop that was Route 152.
19.
Orville Jameson, scratched and muddy and barely able to walk on his bad ankle, sat by the side of the Bailings Road about a half a mile from the Manders farm and spoke into his walkie-talkie. His message was relayed back to a temporary command post in a van parked in the main street of Hastings Glen. The van had radio equipment with a built-in scrambler and a powerful transmitter. OJ's report was scrambled, boosted, and sent to New York City, where a relay station caught it and sent it on to Longmont, Virginia, where Cap sat in his office listening. Cap's face was no longer bright and jaunty as it had been when he biked to work that morning. OJ's report was nearly unbelievable. They had known the girl had something, but this story of sudden carnage and reversal was, at least to Cap, like a bolt of lightning from a clear blue sky. 4 to 6 men dead, the others driven helter-skelter into the woods.
half a dozen cars in flames, a house burning to the ground, a civilian wounded and about to blab to anyone and everyone who cared to listen that a bunch of neo-Nazis had turned up on his doorstep with no warrant and had attempted to kidnap a man and a little girl whom he had invited home to lunch. When O.J. finished his report, and he never really did, he only began to repeat himself in a kind of semi-hysteria, Cap hung up and sat in his deep swivel chair and tried to think. He did not think a covert operation had gone so spectacularly wrong since the Bay of Pigs, and this was on American soil. The office was gloomy and filled with thick shadows now that the sun had got around to the other side of the building, but he didn't turn on the lights. Rachel had buzzed him on the intercom, and he had told her curtly he didn't want to talk to anyone, anyone at all. He felt old. He heard Wanla saying, "I am talking about the potential for destruction." Well, it wasn't just a question of potential any longer, was it? "But we're going to have her," he thought, looking blankly across the room. "Oh, yes, we're going to have her." He thumbed for Rachel. "I want to talk to Orville Jameson as soon as he can be flown here," he said. "And I want to talk to General Brackman in Washington. A1A priority. We've got a potentially embarrassing situation in New York State, and I want you to tell him that right out." "Yes, sir," Rachel said respectfully. "I want a meeting with all six subdirectors at 1900 hours. Also A1A, and I want to talk to the chief of state police up there in New York." They had been part of the search sweep, and Cap wanted to point that out to them. If mud was going to be thrown, he would be sure to save back a good big bucket of it for them. But he also wanted to point out that behind a united front, they might still all be able to come out of this looking fairly decent. He hesitated and then said, "And when John Raidbird calls in, tell him I want to talk to him. I have another job for him." "Yes, sir." Cap let go of the intercom toggle. He sat back in his chair and studied the shadows. "Nothing has happened that can't be fixed," he said to the shadows. That had been his motto all his life. Not printed in Cruel and hung up, not embossed on a copper desk plaque, but it was printed on his heart as truth. Nothing that can't be fixed. Until tonight, until O.J.'s report, he had believed that. It was a philosophy that had brought a poor Pennsylvania miner's kid a long way, and he believed it still, although in a momentarily shaken manner. Between Manders and his wife, they probably had relatives scattered from New England to California, and each one was a potential lever. There were enough top-secret files right here in Longmont to ensure that any congressional hearing on shop methods would be, well, a little hard of hearing. The cars and even the agents were only hardware, although it would be a long time before he would really be able to get used to the idea that Al Steinowitz was gone. Who could there possibly be to replace Al? That little kid and her old man were going to pay for what they had done to Al, if for nothing else. He would see to it. But the girl? Could the girl be fixed? There were ways, there were methods of containment. The McGee files were still on the library cart. He got up, went to them, and began thumbing through them restlessly. He wondered where John Rainbird was at this moment. Washington, D.C. 1. At the moment Cap Hollister had his passing thought about him, John Rainbird was sitting in his room at the Mayflower Hotel watching a television game called The Crosswits. He was naked. He sat in the chair with his bare feet neatly together and watched the program. He was waiting for it to get dark. After it got dark, he would begin waiting for it to get late. When it was late, he would begin waiting for it to get early. When it got early and the pulse of the hotel was at its slowest, he would stop waiting and go upstairs to room 1217 and kill Dr. Wanless. Then he would come down here and think about whatever Wanless would have told him before he died, and sometime after the sun came up, he would sleep, briefly. John Rainbird was a man at peace. He was at peace with almost everything, Cap, the shop, the United States. He was at peace with God, Satan, and the universe. If he was not yet at complete peace with himself, that was only because his pilgrimage was not yet over. He had many coups, many honorable scars. It did not matter that people turned away from him in fear and loathing. It did not matter that he had lost one eye in Vietnam. What they paid him did not matter. He took it, and most of it went to buy shoes. He had a great love of shoes. He owned a home in Flagstaff, and although he rarely went there himself, he had all his shoes sent there. When he did get a chance to go to his house, he admired the shoes. Gucci, Bally, Bass, Adidas, Van Donen. Shoes. His house was a strange forest. Shoe trees grew in every room, and he would go from room to room admiring the shoe fruit that grew on them. But when he was alone, he went barefoot. His father, a full-blooded Cherokee, had been buried barefoot. Someone had stolen his burial moccasins. Other than shoes, John Rainbird was interested in only two things. One of them was death. His own death, of course. He had been preparing for this inevitability for 20 years or more. Dealing death had always been his business and was the only trade he had ever excelled at. He became more and more interested in it as he grew older, as an artist will become more interested in the qualities and levels of light, as writers will feel for character and nuance like blind men reading Braille. What interested him most was the actual leaving, the actual exhalation of the soul, the exit from the body and what human beings knew as life and the passing into something else. What must it be like to feel yourself slipping away? Did you think it was a dream from which you would awake? Was the Christian devil there with his fork ready to jam it through your shrieking soul and carry it down to hell like a piece of meat on a shish kebab? Was there joy? Did you know you were going? What is it that the eyes of the dying see? Rainbird hoped he would have the opportunity to find out for himself. In his business, death was often quick and unexpected, something that happened in the flick of an eye. He hoped that when his own death came, he would have time to prepare and feel everything. More and more lately, he had watched the faces of the people he killed, trying to see the secret in the eyes. Death interested him. What also interested him was the little girl they were so concerned with, this Charlene McGee. As far as Cap knew, John Rainbird had only the vaguest knowledge of the McGees and none at all of Lot 6. Actually, Rainbird knew almost as much as Cap himself, something that surely would have marked him for extreme sanction if Cap had known. They suspected that the girl had some great or potentially great power, maybe a whole batch of them. He would like to meet this girl and see what her powers were. He also knew that Andy McGee was what Cap called a potential mental dominant. But that did not concern John Rainbird. He had not yet met a man who could dominate him. The crosswits ended. The news came on. None of it was good. John Rainbird sat, not eating, not drinking, not smoking, clean and empty and husked out, and waited for the killing time to come around. Two. Earlier that day, Cap had thought uneasily of how silent Rainbird was. Dr. Wanless never heard him. He awoke from a sound sleep. He awoke because a finger was tickling him just below the nose. He awoke and saw what appeared to be a monster from a nightmare hulking over his bed. One eye glinted softly in the light from the bathroom, the light he always left on when he was in a strange place. Where the other eye should have been, there was only an empty crater. Wanless opened his mouth to scream, and John Rainbird pinched his nostrils shut with the fingers of one hand and covered his mouth with the other. Wanless began to thrash. "Shh," Rainbird said. He spoke with the pleased indulgence of a mother to her baby at fresh diaper time. Wanless struggled harder. "If you want to live, be still and be quiet," Rainbird said. Wanless looked up at him, heaved once, and then lay still. "Will you be quiet?" Rainbird asked. Wanless nodded. His face was growing very red. Rainbird removed his hands and Wanless began to gasp hoarsely. A small rivulet of blood trickled from one nostril.
"Who are you? Cap send you?"
"Rainbird," he said gravely. "Cap sent me, yes." Wanless's eyes were huge in the dark. His tongue snaked out and licked his lips. Lying in his bed with the sheets kicked down around his knuckly ankles, he looked like the world's oldest child.
"I have money," he whispered very fast. "Swiss bank account, lots of money.
All yours. Never open my mouth again. Swear before God."
"It's not your money that I want, Dr. Wanless," Rainbird said. Wanless gazed up at him, the left side of his mouth sneering madly, his left eyelid drooping and quivering. "If you would like to be alive when the sun comes up,"
Rainbird said. You will talk to me, Dr. Wanless. You will lecture me. I will be a seminar of one. I will be attentive, a good pupil. And I will reward you with your life, which you will live far away from the view of Cap in the shop. Do you understand?
Yes,
Wanless said hoarsely. Do you agree?
Yes, but what?
Rainbird held two fingers to his lips, and Dr. Wanless hushed immediately. His scrawny chest rose and fell rapidly.
I am going to say two words, Rainbird said, and then your lecture will begin. It will include everything that you know, everything you suspect, everything you theorize. Are you ready for those two words, Dr. Wanless?
Yes,
Dr. Wanless said.
Charlene McGee, Rainbird said.
And Dr. Wanless began to speak. His words came slowly at first, and then he began to speed up. He talked. He gave Rainbird the complete history of the Lot 6 tests and the climactic experiment. Much of what he said Rainbird already knew, but Wanless also filled in a number of blank spots. The professor went through the entire sermon he had given Cap that morning, and here it did not fall on deaf ears. Rainbird listened carefully, frowning sometimes, clapping softly, and chuckling at Wanless's toilet training metaphor. This encouraged Wanless to speak even faster, and when he began to repeat himself, as old men will, Rainbird reached down again, pinched Wanless's nose shut with one hand again, and covered his mouth with the other again.
Sorry, Rainbird said.
Wanless bucked and sunfished under Rainbird's weight. Rainbird applied more pressure, and when Wanless's struggles began to lessen, Rainbird abruptly removed the hand he had been using to pinch Wanless's nose shut. The sound of the good doctor's hissing breath was like air escaping from a tire with a big nail in it. His eyes were rolling wildly in their sockets, rolling like the eyes of a fear-maddened horse, but they were still too hard to see. Rainbird seized the collar of Dr. Wanless's pajama jacket and yanked him sideways on the bed so that the cold white light from the bathroom shone directly across his face. Then he pinched the doctor's nostrils closed again. A man can sometimes survive for upward of 9 minutes without permanent brain damage if his air is cut off and he remains completely quiet. A woman, with slightly greater lung capacity and a slightly more efficient carbon dioxide disposal system, may last 10 or 12. Of course, struggling in terror cuts that survival time a great deal. Dr. Wanless struggled briskly for 40 seconds, and then his efforts to save himself began to flag. His hands beat lightly at the twisted granite that was John Rainbird's face. His heels drummed a muffled retreat tattoo on the carpeting. He began to drool against Rainbird's calloused palm. This was the moment. Rainbird leaned forward and studied Wanless's eyes with a childlike eagerness. But it was the same, always the same. The eyes seemed to lose their fear and fill instead with a great puzzlement. Not wonder, not dawning comprehension or realization or awe, just puzzlement. For a moment, those two puzzled eyes fixed on John Rainbird's one, and Rainbird knew he was being seen. Fuzzily, perhaps fading back and back as the doctor went out and out, but he was being seen. Then there was nothing but glaze. Dr. Joseph Wanless was no longer staying at the Mayflower Hotel. Rainbird was sitting on his bed with a life-size doll. He sat still, one hand still over the doll's mouth, the other pinching the doll's nostrils tightly together. It was best to be sure. He would remain so for another 10 minutes. He thought about what Wanless had told him concerning Charlene McGee. Was it possible that a small child could have such a power? He supposed it might be. In Calcutta, he had seen a man put knives into his body, his legs, his belly, his chest, his neck, and then pull them out, leaving no wounds. It might be possible, and it was certainly interesting. He thought about these things, and then found himself wondering what it would be like to kill a child. He had never knowingly done such a thing, although once he had placed a bomb on an airliner and the bomb had exploded, killing all 67 aboard, and perhaps one or more of them had been children, but that was not the same thing. It was impersonal. It was not a business in which the death of children was often required. They were not, after all, some terrorist organization like the IRA or the PLO, no matter how much some people, some of the yellow bellies in the Congress, for instance, would like to believe they were. They were, after all, a scientific organization. Perhaps with a child the result would be different. There might be another expression in the eyes at the end, something besides the puzzlement that made him feel so empty, and so, yes, it was true, so sad. He might discover part of what he needed to know in the death of a child. A child like this Charlene McGee. "My life is like the straight roads in the desert," John Rainbird said softly. He looked absorbedly into the dull blue marbles that had been the eyes of Dr. Wanless. "But your life is no road at all, my friend. My good friend." He kissed Wanless first on one cheek, and then on the other. Then he pulled him back onto the bed and threw a sheet over him. It came down softly, like a parachute, and outlined Wanless's jutting and now tideless nose and white lawn. Rainbird left the room. That night he thought about the girl who could supposedly light fires. He thought about her a great deal. He wondered where she was, what she was thinking, what she was dreaming. He felt very tender about her, very protective. By the time he drifted off to sleep at just past 6 a.m., he was sure the girl would be his. Tashmore, Vermont. 1. Andy and Charlie McGee arrived at the cottage on Tashmore Pond 2 days after the burning at the Manders farm. The Willies hadn't been in great shape to start with, and the muddy plunge over the woods roads that Irv had directed them onto had done little to improve it. When dusk came on the endless day that had begun in Hastings Glen, they had been less than 20 yards from the end of the second and worse of the two woods roads. Below them, but screened off by a heavy growth of bushes, was Route 22. Although they couldn't see the road, they could hear the occasional swish and whine of passing cars and trucks. They slept that night in the Willies, bundled up for warmth. They set out again the next morning, yesterday morning, at just past 5 a.m., with daylight nothing but a faint white tone in the east. Charlie looked pallid and listless and used up. She hadn't asked him what would happen to them if the roadblocks had been shifted east. It was just as well, because if the roadblocks had been shifted, they would be caught, and that was simply all there was to it. It was no question of ditching the Willies, either. Charlie was in no shape to walk, and for that matter, neither was he. So Andy had pulled out onto the highway, and all that day in October they had jigged and jogged along secondary roads under a white sky that promised rain but never quite delivered it. Charlie slept a great deal, and Andy worried about her, worried that she was using the sleep in an unhealthy way, using it to flee what had happened instead of trying to come to terms with it. He stopped twice at roadside diners and picked up burgers and fries. The second time he used the $5 bill that the van driver, Jim Paulson, had laid on him. Most of the remaining phone change was gone. He must have lost some of it out of his pockets during that crazy time at the Manders place, but he didn't recall it. Something else was gone as well. Those frightening, numb places on his face had faded away sometime during the night. Those he didn't mind losing. Most of Charlie's share of the burgers and fries went uneaten. Last night they had driven into a highway rest area about an hour after dark. The rest area was deserted. It was autumn, and the season of the Winnebagoes had passed for another year. A rustic wood-burned sign read, "No camping, no fires, leash your dog, $500 fine for littering." "They're real sports around here," Andy muttered, and drove the Willies down the slope beyond the far edge of the gravel parking lot and into a copse beside a small chuckling stream. He and Charlie got out and went wordlessly down to the water. The overcast held, but it was mild. There were no stars visible, and the night seemed extraordinarily dark. They sat down for a while and listened to the brook tell its tale. He took Charlie's hand, and that was when she began to cry. Great, tearing sobs that seemed to be trying to rip her apart. He took her in his arms and rocked her. "Charlie," he murmured, "Charlie, Charlie, don't. Don't cry. Please don't make me do it again, Daddy," she wept. "Because if you said to, I'd do it, and then I guess I'd kill myself. So please, please, never." "I love you," he said. "Be quiet and stop talking about killing yourself. That's crazy talk." "No," she said, "it isn't. Promise, Daddy." He thought for a long time and then said slowly, "I don't know if I can, Charlie, but I promise to try. Will that be good enough?" Her troubled silence was answer enough. "I get scared, too," he said softly.
Daddies get scared, too. You better believe it. They spent that night, too, in the cab of the Willys. They were back on the road by 6 o'clock in the morning. The clouds had broken up, and by 10 o'clock it had become a flawless Indian summery day. Not long after they crossed the Vermont state line, they saw men riding ladders like masts and tossing apple trees, and trucks in the orchards filled with bushel baskets of macks. At 11:30 they turned off Route 34 and onto a narrow, rutted dirt road marked private property, and something in Andy's chest loosened. They had made it to Grandpa McGee's place. They were here. They drove slowly down toward the pond, a distance of perhaps a mile and a half. October leaves, red and gold, swirled across the road in front of the Jeep's blunt nose. Just as glints of water began to show through the trees, the road branched in two. A heavy steel chain hung across the smaller branch, and from the chain a rust-flecked yellow sign, "No trespassing by order of county sheriff." Most of the rust flecks had formed around 6 or 8 dimples in the metal, and Andy guessed that some summer kid had spent a few minutes working off his boredom by plinking at the sign with his .22, but that had been years ago. He got out of the Willys and took his key ring out of his pocket. There was a leather tab on the ring with his initials AMCG, almost obliterated. Vicky had given him that piece of leather for Christmas one year, a Christmas before Charlie had been born. He stood by the chain for a moment, looking at the leather tab, then at the keys themselves. There were almost 2 dozen of them. Keys were funny things. You could index a life by the keys that had a way of collecting on your key ring. He supposed that some people, undoubtedly people who had realized a higher degree of organization than he had, simply threw their old keys away, just as those same organizational types made a habit of cleaning their wallets out every 6 months or so. Andy had never done either. Here was the key that opened the east wing door of Prince Hall back in Harrison, where his office had been. His key to the office itself, to the English department office. Here was the key to the house in Harrison that he had seen for the last time on the day the shop killed his wife and kidnapped his daughter. 2 or 3 more he couldn't even identify. Keys were funny things, all right. His vision blurred. Suddenly, he missed Vicky, and needed her as he hadn't needed her since those first black weeks on the road with Charlie. He was so tired, so scared, and so full of anger. In that moment, if he'd had every employee of the shop lined up in front of him along Grantham's Road, and if someone had handed him a Thompson submachine gun, "Daddy?" It was Charlie's voice, anxious. "Can't you find the key?" "Yes, I've got it," he said. It was among the rest, a small Yale key in which he had scratched TP for Tashmore Pond with his jackknife. The last time they had been here was the year Charlie was born, and now Andy had to wiggle the key a little before the stiff tumblers would turn. Then the lock popped open, and he laid the chain down on the carpet of fall leaves. He drove the Willys through and then re-padlocked the chain. The road was in bad shape, Andy was glad to see. When they came up regularly every summer, they would stay 3 or 4 weeks, and he would always find a couple of days to work on the road. Get a load of gravel from Sam Moore's gravel pit and put it down in the worst of the ruts, cut back the brush, and get Sam himself to come down with his old dragger and even it out. The camp road's other, broader fork led down to almost 2 dozen camp homes and cottages strung along the shorefront, and those folks had their road association annual dues, August business meeting, and all, although the business meeting was really only an excuse to get really loaded before Labor Day came and put an end to another summer. But Grantham's place was the only one down this way, because Grantham himself had bought all the land for a song back in the depths of the Depression. In the old days, they'd had a family car, a Ford wagon. He doubted if the old wagon would have made it down here now, and even the Willys with its high axles bottomed out once or twice. Andy didn't mind at all. It meant that no one had been down here. "Will there be electricity, Daddy?" Charlie asked. "No," he said, "and no phone either. We don't dare get the electricity turned on, kiddo. It'd be like holding up a sign saying, 'Here we are.' But there are kerosene lamps and 2 range oil drums, if the stuff hasn't been ripped off, that is." That worried him a little. Since the last time they'd been down here, the price of range oil had gone up enough to make the theft worthwhile, he supposed. "Will there be..." Charlie began. "Holy shit," Andy said. He jammed on the brakes. A tree had fallen across the road up ahead, a big old birch pushed down by some winter storm.
I guess we walk from here. It's only a mile or so anyway. We'll hike it. Later he would have to come back with Granther's one-handed buck and cut the tree up. He didn't want to leave Irv's willies parked here. It was too open. He ruffled her hair. Come on. They got out of the willies and Charlie scooted effortlessly